Years ago, he had nearly died as a result of his knife snagging as he tried to draw it from a collar sheath. But there was no such thing as an ideal hiding place for a knife. There was always the possibility that a hidden blade could snag or catch on clothing if the owner tried to draw it too quickly. He glanced around the room. There was a low buzz of conversation from the other people seated around the walls. There were about 20 of them in all. The rest were doubtless still on duty in the castle. They'd arrive as the day drew on and the evening mealtime approached. "I'll play a little after we've eaten," Will told Maddie. "Once I've got their attention, you slip away and check out the higher floors of the keep. We need to know where Lassini is holding the prince." "Is there anything specific I should be looking for?" Maddie asked. "Look for any rooms where there are guards on duty. Anywhere they seem to want to keep nosy strangers out." "Do you think he'll be in the keep?" He shook his head. "Probably not. But we might as well start here." Some 20 minutes later, the serving staff from the basement kitchen brought the evening meal in. They placed half a dozen big cauldrons on the tables, spacing them out. Other servers brought stacks of wooden bowls and spoons. The numbers of people waiting in the room had doubled as the meal time grew closer. Will glanced at one of the high-set windows in the wall, above the row of sleeping spaces. It was still daylight outside. Obviously, the staff ate at an earlier hour than the knights and nobles in Lassini's dining hall. He and Maddie found places at one of the tables, and he ladled food from one of the big pots into two of the wooden bowls. He dipped up a spoon and tasted cautiously. The meal, a lamb and vegetable stew, was surprisingly good, although a little over-flavoured for his taste. "Heavy on the garlic," he muttered. "Typical Gallic cooking." Maddie had no such reservations, and she ate quickly, dipping a broken-off piece from a long bread loaf into the stew. There was more vegetable than lamb, she noted, but the food was hot and well-flavoured. The gravy was rich, and the bread was light and airy, unlike the flat, heavy loaves she was used to in Araluen. She finished her bowl in quick time and glanced around the room. Seeing other diners helping themselves to additional servings, she spooned more of the stew into her bowl and continued eating. "Slow down," Will cautioned her. "You'll give yourself a bellyache." But she noticed that he too had a second helping, then pushed his bench back from the table, a satisfied look on his face. "Not bad," he said contentedly. "Not bad at all." The servers had set out jugs of water, ale, wine and coffee on the tables. Will tasted the wine and pulled a face. It wasn't to his liking. He poured himself a mug of coffee instead, looking round hopefully for a bowl of honey. But there was none, and he shrugged, drinking the coffee unsweetened. He would have preferred to have it sweetened, but it was good coffee, with a rich flavour, and eminently drinkable, he thought. Gradually, the other diners finished their meals, and the servers took the pots and bowls away, leaving the coffee and wine jugs on the tables. The people seated at the tables broke up into smaller groups, placing their stools in circles and leaning forward toward each other as they conversed in lowered tones. Will rose and moved to his sleeping space, where his mandola was on his bed. He opened the leather case and removed the instrument, checking its tuning as he did so. Maddie, who had gone with him, noticed several of the people sitting around the room glancing at him curiously. "You're going to perform?" she asked. He shook his head. "I'm going to sit quietly to one side and provide a little background music," he said. "People don't always want their conversations interrupted. Those who want to listen rather than talk can gather round me." He settled his mandola's strap around his shoulders and turned toward the tables once more. "You wait here," he said. "Once I've drawn a bit of attention away from you, slip away and see if you can find where they're holding Prince Gilles." Maddie waited by her sleeping niche, pretending to store her clothes on the hanging hooks and shelves provided. Will moved across the room, hooking a stool with his foot, then carrying it to a spot against the far wall. He sat down and began quietly strumming a few chords. There was a brief lull in the various conversations around the room, as people turned to look at him. Most resumed their conversations, but some turned their stools in his direction as he began to sing quietly. After the first song, half a dozen moved their stools into a small semicircle around him. He smiled at them and struck up another song. Maddie glanced around. Nobody seemed to be paying any attention to her. Quietly, she slipped away along the row of sleeping spaces and out the big double doors. 33. From the ground floor, there was a wide central stairway leading to the higher levels of the keep. Maddie clung to the walls of the big room, staying out of sight as far as possible. Once she started upward, she would be open to challenge. She had no excuse for being in this part of the castle, other than curiosity, and she didn't think that would be a particularly valid excuse if she were spotted. Fortunately, the daylight was nearly gone, and the interior of the building was poorly lit. What windows there were small and narrow. Tall, wide windows didn't make for a good defensive design. Still, as she mounted the wide stairway, she felt horribly exposed and visible. She stayed close to the balustrade, her soft-soled boots whispering on the timber stairs, and ghosted her way upward. Her skin crawled as she imagined dozens of unseen eyes watching her progress. The first floor was the site for Lassini's office and living quarters. The door to the office was open, and she could see the massive desk, strewn with papers and notes. There was no sign of the Baron or any of his staff. She assumed he would be in his living quarters, preparing for the evening meal. She edged around the stairway. The wide timber stairs continued from this level up to the third. She paused at the foot of the second flight of stairs, peering upward, exposing as little of her body as possible to any observer who might be looking down from the third floor. Seeing nothing, hearing nothing, she went upward again, moving more quickly in her eagerness to be finished with this exposed position. She stopped at the top of the steps and took stock. This was obviously the dining hall for the Baron and his senior staff. As she watched, servants were moving among the long tables, setting places for that night's meal. None of the serving staff paid any attention to her, if they noticed her at all. She quickly continued up to the next floor. As she reached the top of the stairs, the seneschal's office, where she and Will had requested accommodation, was directly ahead of her. The large brass-bound door was closed, and there was no sound of movement from within. She looked around the third floor. The other three walls were lined with heavy timber doors, all closed. Light was provided by a line of torches set in sconces on the walls. She quickly moved to a spot halfway between two, where the shadows were thickest. She paused, watching and listening. There was no sound, although the beating of her heart seemed deafening to her. Crouched back in the shadows, she studied the layout of this floor. The wide central stairway went no farther, and she looked for access to the higher floors. In two of the corners, the line of heavy timber doors was broken by narrower, open doorways. Inside one, she could see the first few rows of steps leading upward. She hurried toward the nearest doorway and peered inside. A flight of steps spiralled around the interior of the narrow space. As was always the case in castles, the spiral ran from left to right. This meant that an attacker coming up the stairs would have to expose his entire body to use his sword, while a right-handed defender would only need to expose his right arm. Maddie peered upward. The light in the stairway was uncertain. There were no torches set in the wall. There was only the light reflected from the third and fourth levels to illuminate the stairs. She mounted them quickly, her ears alert for the sound of anyone coming down. If that happened, she'd have to turn and race back down the stairs and find a hiding place on the floor below. But there was no sound of anyone moving, and she emerged onto the fourth floor. This was a large open space with high windows set along two walls. The defensive needs weren't as important this high up, she knew. She stepped out into the open space and looked around. The two windowless walls were lined with racks of weapons and armour. This floor was obviously devoted to a weapons practice room and the castle armoury. The tall windows provided light for people practicing their weapon skills. Many of the weapons in the racks were wooden practice weapons, she could see. She turned back to the stairway and continued upward. So far, she had seen nothing that suggested the presence of a prisoner being held in any of the rooms, and the next two floors were similarly disappointing. A narrow corridor ran around each floor, pierced either side with doors. Those on the outer side were spaced farther apart, and she guessed they would be apartments or suites for senior knights and nobles in Lassenyi's court. The doors on the inner side of the corridor were spaced more closely together. She tried one, and the handle moved under her touch, heart pounding. She eased the door open a crack and cautiously peered around. She heard a rustle of movement and froze, ready to run for the stairway. Then the silence was broken by an unmistakable sound. Someone was snoring. She eased the door open farther and peered into the room. A young man, half-dressed, was lying on his back on a narrow bed set opposite the door. His eyes were closed, and his chest rose and fell rhythmically. In addition to the bed, the room contained a table and chair and an armoire. A liveried jerkin was hanging over the back of the chair. A squire, she guessed. The size of the room and the meagre furnishing seemed to bear out the theory. Carefully, she eased the door closed, making as little noise as possible. The snoring continued, muffled now with the closed door between her and the young man. She studied the nearest door on the outer side of the corridor. She moved closer to it and laid her ear against it. From within, she could hear the faint murmur of voices, male and female. That seemed to confirm her theory that these were apartments kept for the senior knights and their families. Silently, she moved down the corridor and listened at the next door. This time, she heard nothing. No voices, no sound of movement from within. She tried the door handle, and it moved easily, the latch slipping open with a soft click. The door opened inward, and she leaned her weight against it, holding the door handle and opening the door several centimetres. She paused. Her heart was thumping, and her pulse was racing. She would have no excuse if she were discovered now. Taking a deep breath, she eased the door open a half metre and peered round the edge, ready to take to her heels at a moment's notice. She was looking into a well-furnished living room. The floor was carpeted with several rugs. Two wing chairs stood either side of the fireplace, and a wooden settle was ranged along one wall. A dining table, set with four straight-backed chairs, was by the window. Several doors led off to other rooms, confirming her guess that this was an apartment or suite. As she looked, she heard a door slam from farther inside the apartment and a male voice speaking. Quickly, she closed the door once more and headed for the stairs. The next floor, when she emerged onto it, was a similar layout. Smaller rooms on the inner side of the corridor and larger suites on the outer side, where the inhabitants would enjoy views out over the lake and the surrounding countryside. It was possible that Prince Gilles was being held in one of the apartments, she reasoned, but there was no sign of guards posted anywhere, which would seem to discount that idea. She hurried along the corridor, stopping at each corner to peer around and make sure nobody was watching. The corridor was deserted, and in a few minutes she was back at her starting point. The tension was unbearable. She was continually keying herself up to round each corner, expecting every moment to run into someone, poised to run for her life. Then, as there was no sign of anyone, she found the adrenaline draining away from her. Her jagged breathing grew more relaxed. She paused, took several deep breaths to calm herself. It was time to leave, she thought. There's no one here, she told herself softly. Just relax. And, as she said the words, the door beside her opened and a burly figure, clad in green and yellow livery, emerged from one of the apartments and barged into her. There was a moment's confusion as the two of them stumbled apart. The man uttered a surprised oath, then peered at her suspiciously. "Who are you?" he demanded. "What are you doing here?" He grabbed hold of her arm in a powerful grip. "Changing the bed linen," she replied immediately, and turned to go. But the man wasn't satisfied. "Where's the linen cart?" he asked roughly. She knew that the chambermaids would have push carts piled with fresh linen, with space underneath for the used sheets and pillows that they were replacing. She pointed down the corridor. "There." As he turned his head, she tried to pull free of his grasp. Catching him by surprise, she nearly made it. Her arm slipped from his hand, but he instantly snatched at her again, grabbing her by the wrist, and pulled her toward him. He was expecting her to pull away from him again. Instead, she suddenly stepped toward him. Caught by surprise, he instinctively pushed back against her. As he did, she grabbed a handful of his tunic, bent her legs, and shoved her backside into his body. With their bodies pinned together, she straightened her knees, using the strength of her legs to lift him from the floor, and heaved him up and over her hip in a whirl of arms and legs. He hit the floor with a shattering thud. The breath was driven from him in a loud woof. Maddie ran. She glanced back as she reached the stairwell. The knight was staggering awkwardly to his feet, supporting himself against the corridor wall. Then he lurched after her, breathing heavily. She flew down the first flight of stairs, her soft boots making virtually no sound. She had reached the floor below when she heard his heavy boots on the steps above her. She went down the next flight, two at a time. This time, when she reached the bottom, she darted out into the corridor and set off for the second spiral staircase, set at the next corner of the tower. She reached it and plunged into the dimly lit interior. Behind her, she heard the lumbering steps of her pursuer coming down from the next floor. She paused, listening as the footsteps went past the entrance to the stairwell and the man continued downward. Then, figuring he would assume that this was the last thing she would do, she went back up the stairs again. This time, she kept going until she reached the top floor. It was used for storage. Old furniture, armour, boxes of clothing and bedding were piled in the centre of the floor. At each wall, a doorway led out onto a balcony, which afforded a view over the surrounding countryside. She assumed that this floor would be used as a lookout in time of war. She finally relaxed, letting her breathing settle. She pushed a pile of folded curtains to one side to make a hiding place, and crouched down behind them. She didn't think the knight would continue to hunt for her once he realized she'd given him the slip, but she waited for an hour, until it was full dark, then crept down the stairs to the common room. As she entered, she saw Will sitting to one side, talking to several of the kitchen hands. His mandola was on the table between them. He saw her enter and glanced at her, one eyebrow raised in a question. She shook her head and made her way to her sleeping space. She dropped onto the bed, exhausted by the tension of her encounter and near capture. Wearily, she pulled the curtain closed. 34. Behind the keep, in the northwestern corner of the bailey, there was a terraced garden. It was intended to provide an outdoor recreation area for the castle inhabitants, in those times when enemies might be attacking and the castle gates were kept closed. After all, Maddie thought, the staff and garrison could hardly spend all their time enclosed in their rooms or in the public halls of the keep. There would have to be some sense of normality maintained in their day-to-day living. The gate and portcullis were both open today, of course. There was no sign of an apparent threat to the castle, and the usual stream of traffic made its way across the causeway and into the bailey. But they came nowhere near the pleasant, grassy space. The kitchens and storerooms were located on the opposite side of the castle, and access to the garden was limited to those staying within the castle. Will and Maddie were sitting on one of the stone benches set under an arbour of trees. It was mid-afternoon, and Will had been playing and singing to a small but appreciative group in the garden. Now he had set the mandola aside, and the audience had drifted away, some of them tossing coins into the open mandola case on the grass between his feet. He waited till the last of the audience had moved away, out of earshot. This was the first chance he and Maddie had to discuss her exploration the previous night. The common room had too many people, and too many potential hiding places for eavesdroppers. Here in the open, they could see if anyone came too close. "Do you think he'd recognize you again?" he asked. Maddie had already told him about her encounter on the upper floor of the keep. She shook her head. "I was wearing my cap, and I had my hair bundled up under it. I doubt he even knew I was a girl." Will smiled. Even if he suspected it, his manly pride would hardly let him admit to it. "You seem to have thrown him about like a sack of oats. Girls aren't supposed to do that." "I'll bear it in mind next time I meet him," Maddie said. "Not that I'd recognize him, either. It was pretty dark in that corridor, although I'd recognize his livery," she added as an afterthought. "Odds are, he's done nothing more about it. Probably thought you were sneaking around looking for something to steal. He may have reported it to the seneschal, but what can he do about it? You're long gone, and nothing was stolen. That's hardly worth starting a hue and cry." "At least we know that the prince isn't in the keep," Maddie said. "I didn't really think he would be," Will replied. "Too much coming and going in the keep. Too many people around. He's probably in one of the towers, on a high floor. I guess that Lassany would want to keep him out of sight as far as possible." "Speak of the devil," Maddie said in a warning tone. Will followed the direction of her gaze. Baron Lassany was strolling through the garden area, accompanied by his seneschal. The two men were deep in conversation, their heads close together, which gave Will and Maddie a good opportunity to study him. They had seen him before, but only at a distance, and only fleetingly. He was taller than average, which meant he had to stoop to speak to the shorter man beside him. He was powerfully built, with broad shoulders. There appeared to be no excess fat on him. He was fit-looking and muscular. His hair was close-cropped, black, but with traces of grey at the temples. His skin was olive-complexioned, and he had no beard. Dark brown eyes, almost black, were set under heavy brows. They made Maddie think of a hawk's eyes, and, like a hawk, they seemed not to blink. The nose was strong, and the features were even. All in all, the Baron was a handsome figure of a man. He wore a green surcoat, emblazoned with a yellow hawk's body in plan form, stylized so that the wings formed a heart's shape. The hawk clasped a short spear in its talons. As they strolled, the Seneschal's eyes lit on Will and Maddie sitting on the stone bench. He said something to the Baron and pointed in their direction. Those dark brown eyes trained on them and studied them closely. Maddie shifted awkwardly. She had the feeling that Lassany could see past her innocent exterior and read her thoughts. Will seemed to sense her discomfort. "Relax," he said softly, as the two men changed direction and strode across the grass toward them. As they came closer, Will rose from the bench, tipping Maddie's elbow to prompt her to do the same. Baron Lassany stopped a few metres short of them, feet apart, fists on his hips as he stared at them. It was an aggressive stance, a dominant one. It was the body language of a man who knew he was looking at his inferiors. "My lord," said Will, bowing his head.
"You're the jongleur," Lassany said.
His voice was deep and resonant, courtesy of that heavy-set body and broad chest. "That's right, my lord. I'm Will Accord of Araluin. This is my daughter, Madeline." The hawk-like gaze switched briefly to Maddie, who dropped into a curtsy. She kept her eyes and face down so that Lassany wouldn't see the twist on her lips. She hated curtsying. It was demeaning and submissive. If a man simply had to bow his head, as Will had done, why shouldn't a woman do the same? Lassany's gaze flicked back to Will, who straightened now from his bow.
"I'm told you're quite good," the Baron said.
Will smiled ingratiatingly.
"You're very kind, my lord."
Lassany shook his head suddenly. His movements all tended to be sudden and abrupt.
"Aye. Didn't say so," he said. "I said, I'm told you're quite good. I'll reserve my opinion until I hear you perform."
Will said nothing. There was nothing to say, after all. He inclined his head once more. Lassany turned to the Seneschal.
"When can we hear him, Gaston?"
he asked, then answered his own question.
"Tomorrow night?"
The Seneschal nodded.
"You are dining your nobles and knights tomorrow night, sir. That would be a good opportunity."
"Tomorrow night, then, at the 9th hour,
Lassany told Will. He stepped closer and flicked a disparaging hand at Will's soiled outfit.
"Try to clean yourself up. You look like a beggar, not a jongleur."
"Yes, sir," Will said, maintaining his obsequious smile with an effort.
The Baron snorted dismissively and turned away, resuming his conversation with the Seneschal as if Maddie and Will didn't exist. Again Will bowed and Maddie curtsied.
"So, Gaston, let's lean on that wine merchant. He's making a fortune from us. Time to make it a little less."
"Yes, my lord," the Seneschal replied, and they moved out of earshot.
The two rangers straightened. They exchanged a glance.
"Tidy yourself up,"
Maddie said, in a fair imitation of Lassany's bullying tone. Will rolled his eyes, and they resumed their seats on the bench. "At least we know most of his knights will be dining together tomorrow," Will said. "That'll give you a chance to take a look at the towers. That's where I guess he's holding Gilles." Maddy gazed around at the four towers that formed the corners of the chateau. They were identical, each with a heavy wooden door at the base, giving onto the bailey. They rose to the level of the curtain wall without any break in their walls, other than a few narrow slits to allow archers or crossbowmen to shoot down into the interior. Above the level of the fighting platform, around the top of the crenellated walls, there were larger openings, denoting rooms or suites of rooms. "Where do I start?" Maddy said. One tower looked much the same as the others. As she spoke, they heard the door to the keep open and then bang shut. Two kitchen hands were crossing the cobbled courtyard, heading for the southwestern tower. They carried a tray covered with a napkin and a large pottery flagon and several wooden goblets. As Maddy and Will watched, they paused at the heavy door and hammered on it three times. There was a short pause, then the door creaked open. Inside, the two observers could see several armed soldiers. The soldiers checked briefly to see who was outside, then opened the door farther to allow the kitchen hands to enter. A few seconds later, the door closed behind them. Even from this distance, Will and Maddy heard the metallic jangle of a key turning in the heavy lock. "Let's see," Will mused. "The midday meal is just over, and a tray of food and wine is being taken to someone in the southwest tower. I'd say that's where you might find young Gilles." 35. "I'll nose around tonight," Maddy said, as they headed back to the keep. "I need to work out how to get into the tower and up the stairs. Then, when you're singing tomorrow night, I'll get inside and see if I can find where they're holding Gilles." "I'd say you're going to have to climb the outside of the tower," Will said. "You need to get past the door guards, and that seems to be the only way to do it." Maddy paused and turned to look back at the tower. It was constructed from large granite blocks, and, from this distance, they looked to have plenty of gaps for potential hand and footholds. She was an accomplished climber, and had no fear of heights. "I wouldn't worry about the first three floors," Will said. "The ones up to the level of the curtain wall. They'll be ready rooms for defenders when the castle is under attack. Above the level of the curtain wall, you can see there are apartments. That's where you'll find him." "I think I'll take a closer look at the stonework," Maddy said, turning back toward the tower. Will stopped her with a hand on her arm. "Don't go looking at the southwest tower," he cautioned her. "If that's where they're holding Gilles, you don't want to arouse any suspicions. Have a look at the northwest tower. They're the same construction. If one is climbable, the others will be." She nodded and strolled back toward the garden where they had been sitting. Will watched her go for a minute or so, then turned away toward the keep. Doing her best to look casual, Maddy strolled through the grassed garden area, angling toward the corner tower. Baron Lassany and the Seneschal had gone back to their offices, and there were only a handful of people still in the garden. The rest had gone back to their workplaces now that the lunch hour was over. She stopped to peer into a fish pond set under an outcrop of rock. Large carp nosed the surface of the green water, searching for errant insects that might have fallen in, leaving expanding rings on the surface as they sank back into the depths. She took the opportunity to look around, but nobody seemed to be interested in her movements. She resumed her casual stroll, moving closer to the northwest tower. She checked her surroundings once more. The nearest people to her were a young couple standing under a low tree, holding hands and looking deep into each other's eyes. They definitely weren't interested in her, she thought. She moved closer to the tower, studying the rough grey walls and the heavy iron-reinforced door at the base. A few metres away, a wooden stairway led up to the fighting platform that ran along the inside of the crenellated curtain wall. She nodded thoughtfully to herself, turning to look back at the southwest tower. There was a similar flight of steps there. Obviously, the steps were intended to provide access for defenders to reach the walkway that ran along the inside of the wall. Additional access would come from the towers, she realized. She looked back at the one near her. At the level of the walkway above her, she could see another timber door giving access from the tower. Considering Will's comment about the lower levels of the tower providing barracks for defenders, it made sense that they would be able to access the defensive walkways from within. She checked around her again. Nobody was watching her. The young couple had withdrawn into the shadows of the tree and were locked in an embrace. "Young love," she muttered derisively. Then she moved close to the tower, studying its construction. The massive granite blocks were fitted together roughly. They were unevenly shaped, leaving substantial gaps between each one, gaps that had been loosely filled with mortar. Over the years, much of the exterior mortar had worn away. She slipped her right hand into one of the horizontal gaps. It was a firm handhold, with plenty of room for her hand. Tentatively, she slipped her toe into another gap at ground level and tested her weight on it. Again, there was plenty of room and plenty of support. She would have no trouble climbing the wall, she thought, although she would be exposed to view for the lower section of the climb, up to the walkway. She stepped back from the wall, and not a moment too soon. The heavy door, only a few meters away, suddenly slammed open, and a guard stepped out. He looked at her, a mixture of surprise and suspicion on his face. "What do you want?" he demanded roughly. "What are you doing here?"
"Just looking around," she said innocently. "Exploring the castle. I only got here yesterday."
She smiled at him, but there was no answering smile. He continued to glare at her. "Could I take a peek inside?" she asked artlessly, gesturing toward the dark interior of the tower behind him. "I've never seen inside a real castle before."
"No," he snapped angrily. "Do you think I'm running sightseeing tours here? Clear off, out of it."
He raised a threatening hand, and she stepped quickly back, out of reach. "All right," she said hurriedly. "I'm sorry." Making apologetic gestures, she hurried quickly back through the garden. She glanced back once when she was 15 meters or so away. The soldier was still watching her. Then, as she looked back, he made a further threatening gesture and stepped back inside, slamming the door behind him. Despite the distance, she heard the rattle of a large key in a lock. She slowly resumed her walk, rubbing her chin thoughtfully with her finger and thumb. Why was the guard so aggressive? She wondered. Why was he so keen for her to stay away from the tower? Was it because this was where Prince Shiel was being held captive? That would certainly explain his overzealousness and his warning for her to keep away. Then she considered further. They hadn't seen any food being taken to this tower, she realized. And the towers and ramparts were essential components in the castle's defensive structure. It was logical that the sentries would discourage random visitors and prying eyes. She had no doubt that if she approached any of the other towers, she'd receive the same short shrift and lack of welcome. But she wasn't about to test her theory. The southwest tower would seem to be the most likely place to find the prince. "Besides, I have to start somewhere," she said to herself, "so it might as well be there." Head down and deep in thought, she didn't notice the old beggar sitting under a tree in the garden until she was almost level with him.
"S'il vous plaît, mademoiselle," he said in a gravelly voice, snapping her out of her distracted state.
She glanced quickly at him.
He must have been among the many day visitors who streamed across the causeway each morning seeking entrance to the castle, she thought. He was bent over, not looking at her, but with a begging cup held out to her. His white hair and beard were long and unkempt, and he was wearing a ragged blue-and-white striped cloak. She reached into her purse and found a few small coins, dropping them into his cup and moving on.
"Thank you, miss,"
he called after her. She had gone another 10 paces before it registered with her that he had used the common tongue, not Gaelic, which he had used when he first spoke to her. Yet she hadn't spoken or given him any reason to believe she wasn't Gallican. And there had been something vaguely familiar about him. She turned quickly to look back at him, but there was no sign of the blue-and-white cloaked figure. She frowned. Odd, she thought. Then she shook her head, dismissing the beggar from her thoughts. She had other matters to concern her. "Better not do any more poking around," Will told her, as they sat in a secluded corner of the common room. "You don't want people noticing that you're interested in the towers." She nodded agreement. "I'll keep my distance," she said. "But I want to check out the sentry's schedule tonight. I plan to take the stairs to the walkway at the top of the wall, then move around to the outside of the tower and start my climb from there." Will considered her plan for a few seconds. "Good idea," he said finally. "You'd be fairly conspicuous climbing from ground level. This way, if you move to the outside of the tower, you'll be pretty much out of sight." He paused, then added, "Just make sure you don't fall." Maddie grinned. "That'll be the last thing I do," she said. Will raised an eyebrow. "You might like to rephrase that," he said. The following night, Maddie crouched in the shadows under the stairway that led to the top of the curtain wall. She listened to the measured tread of the sentry's feet on the wooden platform above her. The current batch of sentries had been on duty for just over 2 hours now, with another hour to go before they were due for relief. She had timed their schedule and their patrol patterns the night before. In her mind's eye, she visualized the man on the ramparts above her. At this point, well into his scheduled 3 hours, he would be thinking more about his relief than about possible attackers approaching the castle. It was only human nature, she thought. At the beginning of his watch, the man would be energized and motivated, ready to investigate or query any stray sound or perceived movement. But as the first hour passed, then the second, without any sign of a threat, inevitably, his alertness would be blunted, his motivation dissipated. His hands would grow cold in the brisk night air. His feet would begin to ache from the constant pacing in stiff boots on unyielding planks. And worse than the physical discomforts of patrolling the ramparts would be the boredom that would set in. With no conversation, other than a few casual words with his opposite number as they met in the centre of the walkway, his mind would begin to be dulled by the constant repetition and lack of mental stimulation. She frowned as she thought about it. It was a useful lesson for the future, she thought. If you were assigning men to sentry duty, don't give them all the same start and finish times. Vary them, so there were always fresh eyes and alert minds coming on duty. Above her, she heard the boots scrape as the man reached the end of his section, close to the massive wall of the southwest tower. He paused, resting for a second or two, and she heard the distinct sound of his yawning. Then the boots started again, trudging now and dragging slightly on the rough timbers of the walkway. "Time to go," she said. 36. She swarmed up the stairs like a wraith, staying low, a silent shadow against the dark shadows of the wall behind her. As she neared the top, She heard the sentry turning at the end of his patrol, his boots scuffing the boards, breaking the steady rhythm of his marching. Instantly, she dropped to the rough timber of the staircase, her cloak spread around her, masking her shape and turning her into an anonymous dark mass. She was still below the level of the walkway, so she had no real fear that the sentry would see her. But her heart still beat faster as he came closer. Logic was all very well, but when you were only a few meters away from an armed enemy, it wasn't possible to stay completely unconcerned. Again, the man stopped at the end of his patrol, close to the stone wall of the tower. He stepped closer to the crenellations and peered over the side into the darkness below. Obviously seeing nothing, he sighed and turned again to retrace his path back to the centre of the wall. She let him go a few metres. Then, on hands and knees, she slipped up the rest of the steps and moved across the walkway, crouching in the shadows at the base of the wall where it met the tower. She glanced down the walkway after the sentry. He was 20 meters away, pausing to talk briefly to his opposite number. She would have to remain where she was until he had returned to his start point and turned away again. At that point, the other sentry, even though he would be facing her, would be 40 meters away, and her movements would be shielded by the uncertain light. But she would have no time to waste. As the sentry approached again, she huddled at the base of the wall, her cloak pulled tight around her, her face masked by the deep cowl. She hoped that, this time, the sentry wouldn't choose to peer over the wall. If he did so, he would be almost certain to tread on her. She crouched, eyes down, listening to the footsteps coming closer, expecting any moment for them to stop and to hear the sentry's sharp exclamation of surprise as he spotted her. But he came on, his pace unvarying. For a few seconds, she considered waiting until he had turned and then entering the tower at this level, using the large wooden door. She was certain it was unlocked. She had heard the sentry come through it when he began his vigil, and there had been no sound of a key turning after he had closed the door behind him. That would get her out of sight much more quickly than if she clambered up onto the curtain wall and climbed around to the outside of the tower. But she quickly discarded the idea. The tower room on the other side of the door would probably be a ready room for soldiers assigned to guard duty that night. The next shift were probably dozing on bunks in there at the moment, waiting their turn to take over the watch. That was how things were organised at Castle Araluen, she knew, and at Castle Redmond. There was no reason to suppose things were any different here. If she went into the tower at this level, chances were she would be walking in on up to a dozen armed men. Better to stick to the original plan. Go up a few floors, check to find an unoccupied room, and then gain entry to the tower. Again, the sentry was approaching. She controlled her breathing, keeping it smooth and steady, and, most important, virtually silent. With her head and eyes down, she couldn't see the sentry, but she could hear him and actually sense his presence close to her. It seemed impossible that he wouldn't notice the dark shadow crouched at the base of the wall. He must see her this time, she thought. But she was just a shadow among other shadows. The footsteps stopped. She heard him pivot and then begin to walk away. Incredibly, he had overlooked her, even though she was only a few meters away from him. People see what they expect to see. She heard Will's voice in her mind. He had spent years dinning into her brain that utter stillness was the best form of concealment in a situation like this. The sentry didn't expect to see a small figure crouched in the shadow line at the base of the wall. Therefore, he didn't see her. With a start, she realized she was wasting valuable time thinking about this. The sentry was already a quarter of the way along his beat, and that meant that the far sentry was getting closer, to a point where he might notice her moving. Swiftly, she rose and vaulted up onto the crenellated wall. She took a few seconds to study the surface of the tower wall facing her, then selected two handholds and a gap in the stones for her right foot. She swung herself up and out over the dizzying drop, clinging to the tower wall like a giant spider. Her left foot reached out, searching the uneven tower wall, seeking a crevice to support her. She found one and transferred the bulk of her weight to it, removing her left hand from its hold and reaching along the wall, to the left and upward. She found another sizable gap in the stones, tested it, and found it was firm. Once her left hand was established once more, she removed her right foot from its purchase point and sought another. Always keep 3 points of contact with the wall, Will had taught her. As she set her right foot in a crack, she glanced back over her shoulder. She had moved out and around the curve of the tower a few meters, but she could still see the sentry on his patrol path. He was turning now, having met his opposite number halfway along the wall, and heading back. She froze in place. It was unlikely that the sentry's eyes would be on the outside wall of the tower, but any movement now might catch his attention and give her away. She huddled against the rough stone of the tower, spread-eagled, with her hands and feet wide apart. Below her, she was conscious of the small waves on the lake tumbling against the rocks. The wind out here on the tower was stronger, and it sighed around her ears. For a moment, she had a sensation that her hands were slipping, and that she was about to topple backward and go crashing to the rocks below. But she fought down the treacherous feeling. She was firmly established on the wall with secure hand and footholds. There was nothing to fear, other than the fear of falling itself. She knew some people, in fact most people, suffered from this false perception. It was why so many people would fall from a high place, as if the fall itself beckoned them. She settled her breathing once more, pressing against the stone, feeling the security of her position until the sudden fear passed. She could hear the sentry, pacing slowly along his beat. He had almost reached the end of this pattern. She listened for the slight scuff of his boots as he turned, and when she heard them, she began to climb again. Left hand, right foot, right hand, left foot. She moved smoothly out and up, the only break in her rhythm coming when she didn't immediately locate a new foot or handhold, and was forced to search for one. She glanced back again. She had moved out around the curve of the tower wall now, and the sentry behind her was obscured from her sight. If she moved farther around the wall, she would become exposed to the view of the sentry on the next section. Now was the time to simply move up. She looked up. There was a window a few meters above her, the stone window ledge standing out from the wall. There was no sign of a light behind the window. Either the room behind it was in darkness, or there were curtains drawn across it. She came closer, peering over the rough stone windowsill, and saw that it was the former. There were no curtains, but the room behind the thick, uneven glazing was dark and still. "Which is not to say there's not someone sleeping in there," she muttered to herself. She decided she was still too close to the guard's ready room, just one floor above it. She would go higher before attempting to enter the tower itself. She looked up, leaning out slightly. It was a movement that would have sent another person toppling backward off the window ledge, but after that brief moment of vertigo, she had recovered her equanimity completely and was totally at home on her precarious perch. There was another window, with a similar window ledge, 4 meters above her. As far as she could see, it too was unlit. She felt for handholds on the rough wall of the tower, found purchase for her right foot, and pushed off once more, climbing steadily upward. As she came closer, she saw that she had been mistaken. There was a glimmer of light showing through the window. She pursed her lips in a moo of disappointment and continued up to the next window, a floor above it. This time, there was no light showing. The interior of the room was in darkness. She perched on the windowsill, framing her hands around her eyes and trying to pierce the interior darkness. After several seconds, she gave up. "Only one way to find out," she told herself. She shifted her position slightly and studied the window. It was in two halves, each one hinged and with a latch at the centre. It was a simple tongue and socket lock. She could clearly see the handle that moved the tongue up and down into the socket. The gap between the two halves of the window was a narrow one, too narrow for the heavy blade of the sacks she wore at her belt. She reached behind her neck and felt for the hilt of her throwing knife. Its blade was thinner than the sacks'. She carefully worked it into the gap between the two window halves. It was a tight fit, but the more she waggled it and jiggled it, the more its movement freed. She placed the blade under the lock's tongue and levered upward. For a moment, nothing moved. Then the tongue flew up with a loud click, and the lock was free. She put pressure on the blade, forcing the right-hand window, the one farthest from her, to open outward, catching hold of it before it could bang against the stone window frame. She heard movement inside the room, and the breath stopped in her throat as she listened. Then she relaxed. It was something moving with the wind, which was now coming through the open window, a wall hanging or a curtain. She waited a half minute to see if there was any further noise, any sound of breathing or the stirring of a body under bed covers. Nothing. She slipped the knife back into its sheath behind her neck. Since the window opened outward, she couldn't open the half nearest her as she was blocking its movement. She took the simplest way through the open half, jackknifing her body over the sill so that she went through head first, reaching down with her hands to find the floor. She lowered herself to the floor,